brother. You will not be able to plug in, turn on, and cop out. You will not be able to lose yourself on Skag and skip out for beer during commercials because the revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by Xerox in four parts without commercial interruptions. The revolution will not show you pictures of Nixon blowing a bugle and leading a charge by John Mitchell, General Abrams, and Spiro Agnew to eat hog maws confiscated from a Harlem sanctuary. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be brought to you by the Schaefer Award Theater and will not star Natalie Woods and Steve McQueen or Bullwinkle and Julia. The revolution will not give your mouth sex appeal. The revolution will not get rid of the nub. The revolution will not make you look 5 pounds thinner because the revolution will not be televised, brother. There will be no pictures of you and Willie Mae pushing that shopping cart down the block on the dead run or trying to slide that color TV into a stolen ambulance. NBC will not be able to predict the winner at 8:32 on report from 29 districts. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of pigs shooting down brothers on the instant replay. There will be no pictures of Whitney Young being run out of Harlem on a rail with a brand new process. There will be no slow motion or still life of Roy Wilkins strolling through Watts in a red, black, and green liberation jumpsuit that he has been saving for just the proper occasion. Acres, Beverly Hillbillies, and Hooterville Junction will no longer be so damn relevant, and women will not care if Dick finally got down with Jane on Search for Tomorrow, because black people will be in the street looking for a brighter day. The revolution will not be televised. There will be no highlights on the 11 o'clock news and no pictures of Harry R. Woman Liberationist and Jackie Onassis blowing her nose. The theme song will not be written by Jim Webb or Francis Scott Key, nor sung by Glenn Campbell, Tom Jones, Johnny Cash, Engelbert Humperdinck, or The Rare Earth. The revolution will not be televised. The revolution will not be right back after a message about a white tornado, white lightning, or white people. You will not have to worry about a dove in your bedroom, the tiger in your tank, or the giant in your toilet bowl. The revolution will not go better with coke. The revolution will not fight germs that may cause bad breath. The revolution will put you in the driver's seat. The revolution will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised, will not be televised. The revolution will be no rerun, brothers. The revolution will be live.
Thanks for returning to Great Speeches and Interviews on Axis Sacramento and The Voice. I'm Steve Lerman. Today's program features Robert Poland talking about his book, Back to Full Employment.
So essentially, if we say we're going to build out a renewable economy, we're almost starting from zero with respect to, so for all the good ideas and discussion, it's minuscule, minuscule, minuscule. Wind is a little bigger. The biggest source of renewable energy right now, unfortunately, is corn ethanol, and that is no improvement environmentally relative to fossil fuels.
May I ask which government agency does these loan guarantees? Which government is the Department of Energy?
It's kind of a mess. There's different ones. But the Department of Energy did this one for renewable energy projects.
I wanted to ask about the European countries. Some of them, like Denmark and Germany, are so much further ahead. What were their policies that helped? It was government policies,
yes,
right?
Yes, absolutely. And Germany is saying, you know, they're going 100% off of nuclear, and they want to, what's the number? They want to be at something like, don't quote me, sorry, something like 25 to 30% renewable.
Yes.
Okay, so the two policies, number one, they're way more efficient. So right now, you know, at roughly the same living standard that we have today, they consume half as much energy per person, half. So that's why I say, when I say we're going to build up and invest in efficiency, all I'm saying is in 20 years, get to where they are in Europe today. That's really all I'm saying. And that would be a big challenge. And the other thing they did is that they have these projects like what we're talking about with the military, in which the utilities were forced to buy the renewable power at a fixed long-term price. So investors, including a lot of cooperatives, it wasn't just big business. Most of it was smaller cooperative community developments to put in wind turbines, even in cities. They invested in these things, and you know, the people who invested knew that it wasn't a risk because they had a fixed price, and they knew who their market was. And that idea actually started in California with
the government subsidizing that?
No, the government forced. Basically, the consumer is subsidizing it. The government said, "This is what you, the utility company, you have to do. You have to buy this power." What we're saying is that wind power is close to cost parity, so there's no subsidy. We're just building up the market.
Sure. Can you say something about why the divergence between productivity and wages over the past 40
years?
Well,
Fred could talk about that. I mean, this is, to me, a classic picture of what I understand to be Marxian economics, that the basic idea in Marx is that workers don't have the bargaining power, and business owners, capitalists, get a higher share of overall product. And the more they have bargaining power, the bigger the share they get. So what's happened over the last 35 years that this divergence could occur? And by the way, this is not something that was expected or even widely understood. For example, probably the most prominent economist of any stripe in the world, and certainly the most prominent liberal economist, is Paul Krugman, who has his column in the Times. Krugman wrote an article in the 1990s, and he said, "I can think of no example in human history in which, when productivity goes up, wages don't go up as well." He said, "I can't think of a single example." And meanwhile, it was happening under his nose in the United States. So it's like you didn't have to search into some anthropological obscure studies about something that happened way back when. It's happening in the United States. Now, I don't know if Krugman still believes that. That's of not much importance. But basically, workers lost bargaining power. Now, why did they lose bargaining power? Well, a big factor, I think, was globalization. But it's not globalization per se. It's globalization under the neoliberal regime, which will not support workers' rights to bargain, which will not support workers' rights to form unions, which will not support living wage laws. And so what happens is that, if workers say, and we have, maybe you should talk a little bit about this with respect to Walmart. But I'll just give a background. If workers say, "Well, we want a union, we want a raise," businesses say, "Okay, well, fine, we're moving to China." Now, they don't actually have to move to China. All they have to do is say, "We're thinking about it." And that gives workers less bargaining power. Now, one of the reasons why I'm so big on the green investment is because these are investments that take place, for the most part, within the country, and so businesses don't have that same kind of leverage. Do you want to talk about the Walmart case?
On about Walmart. I believe that the rich get richer, all right, as far as, Walmart. You can ask me anything about Walmart, and I can probably give you an answer for it. Walmart will tell the worker. Well, right now we're doing this thing where we had strikes on Black Friday of this year. All right, and Walmart is now telling us that I belong to this organization called OUR, which is an organization united for respect. All right, and Walmart is not thrilled with us at all. So Walmart is now telling all the employees that OUR no longer exists, and that if anybody talks about it or discusses it, they will be fired. So,
which, of course, is illegal.
Which is illegal.
Yeah.
All right.
But we don't even have a full, labor relations board. Obama tried to fill the seats, and the Supreme Court overturned that. So this makes, these are illegal actions.
And Walmart is constantly doing illegal actions as far as unionizing, all right, because I've been working for Walmart for 13 years now. And when I started working for Walmart, I was in one department, and that was all I took care of, was my department that I was in. Now I work, I'm a cashier now, but yet I have to do work in about 5 other departments as well. And I get just as much pay now as I got a few years ago, all right? The prices keep going up. but my pay is not going up. And as far as, you know, illegal things, you know, in Canada, one of Walmart's stores, they became unionized. The following day, Walmart closed the store down. All right. Here in the States, I think it was in California, you said? The butchers who were cutting the meat, they unionized. There are no longer any meat cutters in Walmart. It's frozen foods now that you get, frozen meats. All right? That's why I say the rich keep getting richer. The six Waltons that are the main Waltons, they are the six richest people in this country. And yet, see, what drives me crazy is the government doesn't do anything about it. You know, one of the incidents right now that's going on that's driving me up a wall is Walmart made this big deal about hiring the vets. These men and women, they risk their lives for their country. And Walmart is offering them jobs. Well, the jobs that they're offering are part-time jobs because Walmart doesn't hire full-time employees anymore. They're offering them part-time jobs, and they're offering them poverty wages. These men and women risk their lives for the country, and that's what Walmart has to offer them.
And they got great publicity. Anyway, so I think that, you know, it is, you know, the unions, you know, it was announced a few weeks ago. Unionization rate is at the lowest point in 97 years. Who's going to stand up and fight for this? So it's a very difficult situation. And that's why over two generations, I think you see this. If the businesses can get away with it, they will get away with it. At the same time, we could build an economy in which workers are treated with respect, in which wages do at least rise with productivity, and it would be a full employment economy. And by the way, rich people would still be living very nicely.
With a lot of skilled workers as defense contractors, how do you envision transitioning from that very specialized work to other areas that take those skills with them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, you know, in some of these really boring technical studies that Fred mentioned and this book that's coming out, we do go through that stuff. I mean, the types of skills that would be required to expand the green economy are not all that different than the types of skills that are required within the military. So, of course, they don't match up perfectly. And, of course, there'd be transitions. And, yeah, the thing that people focus on when we talk about job losses, there will be job losses in coal. Of course, if we're saying we're going to cut the coal industry in half, that means half of the jobs are going to get lost. But there's going to be more jobs in the green economy. So again, it's a matter of thinking about how you do transitions in a fair way. And if we had a super fund, you know, somebody, this is not my line, but I think it's a very good insight. He said we need to have a super fund for people who are going to be displaced by the transition out of the fossil fuel economy. He said, we had a super fund for dirt. How about having a super fund for people? So, yeah, I think that's an important part of the transition. And if we had a super fund, you know, somebody, this is not my line, but I think it's a very good insight. He said, we need to have a super fund for people who are going to be displaced by the transition out of the fossil fuel economy. He said, we had a super fund for dirt. How about having a super fund for people? So, yeah, I think that's an important part of the transition.
You can listen to great speeches and interviews on accesssacramento.org, or you can go to greatspeechesandinterviews.blogspot.com.
Last night I had the strangest dream I've ever had before. I dreamed the world had all paper they were signing. they'd never fight again. And when the paper was all signed and a million copies made, they all joined hands and circled round, and grateful prayers were made.
About the living wage, where do you see a living wage equilibrium being? Like, where would be a good living wage if we're talking about that? Where would be a different?
I think if we want to think in that, of course, it's different for different communities. But if I had to say one number, $13 an hour would be a good minimum living wage. Yes, for one person. You know, there is a proposal now for raising the minimum to 10, which of course I support, which is lower after you correct for inflation. The minimum, rock bottom minimum that people paid in 1968 in today's dollars is over $10 an hour. In 1968, I mean, and I'm not talking about special places like, you know, Santa Monica, California or something. I'm talking about if you walked in, you know, you're 16 years old and you walked into McDonald's somewhere in East Texas, they had to pay you $10 an hour. That was the law, if they were not going to violate the law. So to say that we're going to get to $10 an hour in this country, which is a big fight and isn't even realistic politically, is not really talking about progress. It's talking about reducing the level of regress that we've experienced. And then to get, the reason I said 13 is my colleague at University of Massachusetts, Jeanette Wicks Lim, who I told you to be in touch with. So she did some research and she asked the question, you know, there is a point at which if you keep raising the minimum, there will be some discouragement in terms of employment. And she thinks that cutoff is about $13 an hour.
Business, they cry about, well, I got to put up increased prices now. That can mean that the demand pushes.
Yeah, it could a little bit.
Well, I was reading an article about waitresses. All right. Now, I don't know, they make like $2 or something like that an hour. All right. If they had a minimum wage, all right, it would cost us 10 cents more for our meal.
That's not.
You know,
yeah, that's a lot of my research does that, those kinds of comparisons.
10 cents, you know, I'm going out to dinner. You know, I'm not thinking about how much money I'm spending. I'm going out to dinner. All right? So if I'm spending $12.90 for a meal today, and tomorrow that meal costs me $13, but that girl or that guy, that waiter or waitress, is making a decent living wage, you know, I don't think 10 cents is going to hurt me. And I don't think it's going to hurt anybody who's going out to have dinner.
That's, you know, I did this comparison. Fred mentioned that I was doing these studies in different cities, and one of the ones was in Santa Fe, New Mexico, which has the highest living wage standard in the country right now. So I was part of the project to create the law. And what happened in the city, before the law, actually, it was passed, but then it was challenged. That's why I was there. There was a trial. But while I was there for the trial, so before the law was implemented, the reason there was a trial was because some of the restaurants sued the city and said the law was illegal. Now, at the trial, those same people had the gall to say, this whole thing is really unfair to me because now I'm losing customers because they're saying I don't want to pay a living wage. And in fact, they said, we're losing, you know, there's other restaurants in the city that are putting up signs saying we pay living wages. And guess what? All the people are going there. And you're right. So they pay another 30 cents. They don't even know the difference. Yeah, if you're exactly right. That's what all my research says. Once people decide to go out and they have a range in terms of, you know, they're not going to go to the fanciest restaurant, but if you think I'm going to spend about $13 for a meal, if it's $12.80 or $13.10, you don't even notice it. So, and that's exactly what happened in this city. And it wasn't that people were necessarily big spenders, but for another 20 cents, they would support living wages in their community.
Increase. It doesn't cut down. I'm glad the waitress can make it. It doesn't cut down on other waitressing jobs. Like, well, I got to pay her more and I got to cut somebody out part time.
That is a big debate in economics, whether what really happens is that you stop hiring. And the facts are, the evidence, this is after all years and years and years of debate. The facts are you don't see that. You know, the rate at which it increases may slow down slightly. So like an example, like at a McDonald's, you start to have the machines where people fill up their own glasses instead of having somebody fill up the glass. But generally speaking, there isn't evidence that shows that employment goes down. I mean, it may go down a little bit. Sometimes it may go up a little bit. And it may go up because people are willing to say, you know, we are ethical people. We want to pay. We want to see the workers have a decent wage. And if a restaurant is doing that, great. We'll go to that restaurant. And that is exactly what happened when it became one of the best things about the whole living wage movement, which was in the 90s, early 90s, up till about six, up really up till the crisis, was that you had these discussions in communities where ordinary people just got together. Most people never thought about what you just said. Once they heard it, then it actually meant something to them.
Hello? Hello, is this the Undertakers? Yeah, that's right. What can we do for you? Well, my mother has just died, and I'm not quite sure what to do with her. Well, there's three things we do with your mum. We can burn her, bury her, or dump her.
Dump her?
Yes, in the Thames.
What?
Oh, did you like her?
Yes.
Oh, well, we won't dump her then. We can burn her or bury her.
Well, which would you recommend?
Well, they're both nasty. If we burn her, she gets stuffed in the flames, crackle, 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 which is a bit of a shock because she's not quite dead, but quick, and then we give you a box of ashes, which you can pretend are hers. Or, if you don't want to fry her, you can bury her, and then she gets eaten up by maggots and weevils, nibble, 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 which isn't so hot if, as I said, she's not quite dead.
I'm not quite sure she's dead.
Where is she?
She's in this sack.
Let's have a look. Oh, she looks quite young.
Yes, she was.
Fred, I think we've got an eater.
I'll get the oven on.
Excuse me, are you proposing to eat my mother?
Yeah, not raw. Cook it, she'd be delicious with a few french fries, a bit of stuffing and broccoli, delicious.
No, I couldn't. Well, actually, I do feel a bit peckish.
No, I couldn't. I'll tell you what, we'll eat your mum, then if you feel a bit guilty about it afterwards, we'll dig a grave and you can throw up into it.
Ground control to Major Tom. Ground control to Major Tom. Take your protein pills and put your helmet on. Ground control to Major Tom. 8, 7, 6. Commencing countdown, engines on. 3, 2. Check ignition and may God's love be with you. This is ground control to Major Tom. You've really made the grade, and the papers want to know whose shirt you wear. Now it's time to leave the capsule if you dare. This is Major Tom to ground control. I'm stepping through the door, and I'm floating in a most peculiar way, and the stars look very
That's all, folks.